Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, another show, great show, dealing with metaphysics, spirituality, elements of science as they apply to so many parts of metaphysics, and as well as some questions that many people have about death, because tonight's show is preparing for physical death. Now, before you get remote, start talking about all of, not death, I don't want to deal with death. The thing about death is, I'm going to define it right now, just so you got it. Death is the simplest definition I can think of. Death occurs when, within a body, the senses cannot maintain enough information so that, on a permanent basis, consciousness cannot be maintained in the body. So death is a finality because once consciousness is not maintained, if it's not permanent, then the person isn't truly dead. But if they cannot maintain their consciousness for any length of time, no matter how long you wait or whatever, that person is dead in that body. Now, let me be specific about this so that we don't have any confusion. When some people lose consciousness for protracted periods of time, like they go into a coma or they may even have no heartbeat, or their brain waves may, at least for a short time, seem to be lacking, that isn't necessarily death by the definition that I am giving it. Death really is permanent, meaning that no matter how long you wait, no matter what else you do, that person's senses will not be restored to the level at which any consciousness can exist any longer in that body. There's also some new science and developing metaphysical science with science that will allow, within the next 5 or 10 years, my prediction, allow scientists and metaphysicians and other people to determine the level of consciousness within a specific major center. Some people refer to it as chakra. There's 7 of those, but there's hundreds and hundreds of minor chakras. The major chakras, the 7 in the human being, each have some consciousness attached to them, some level of consciousness. And the totality of that consciousness is what we call the consciousness of a person. Any level of consciousness that can maintain the overall, what we'll call consciousness of the 7 centers collectively, is enough to keep a person alive. And there will be ways to measure this once, quote-unquote, some people involved in science start, we'll say, researching this in a more metaphysical way. And then it will be able to be determined. It's just that we don't have some apparatus that will be, we'll say, needed to be modified from what's presently available. But most of it is a question of understanding consciousness, which is a big deal, because that's misunderstood in modern-day science. So when that occurs, we'll be able to determine the issue of death more clearly than it is done at the present time. And also, by my definition, if one center completely fails, that is a major center, to provide any information, that will prevent a person from maintaining life, because there has to be some information coming from every center in order, even if it's a low amount, in order to maintain this universal level equal to what we call life or life consciousness. Therefore, anytime a center completely fails, major center, or a major chakra, that person is dead in that body. Okay. Now, you may, if you really, if you want to know a lot more about this, you can read about some of it in Life's Hidden Meaning, in chapters 7, and then somewhat in chapter 8. For the rest of the show, at least, chapter 8 would be helpful as well. Okay, so consciousness is this elusive thing that so many, we'll call it, scientists do not understand. But it is not misunderstood in metaphysical terms for many different kinds of spiritual and metaphysical systems. It is misunderstood in terms of its operation, though. How does it work in most of the religious systems? So if we go to Tibetan Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, particularly Zen Buddhism, which is a Japanese version, those types of Buddhist understandings miss some of the concepts necessary to fully understand consciousness and, consequently, chakras and centers. So they've got some goofy ideas, in my opinion. But and then it gets a little more askew if you go into Hindu religion. Hindu is really goofy because they don't understand where the chakras connect to in the other bodies and other things like that. And to some lesser extent, that's true of Zen Buddhists. So you've got this kind of, nebulous area in these religions, but they do recognize what consciousness is more accurately than Western science. So that's the good news, I mean, really, that they have this understanding that is so incredibly lacking in Western science. And so this, when we talk about religions, probably the more accurate religions on consciousness go way back before 600 BC to Zoroastrianism and to some other more, we'll call it ageless wisdom derived or ageless wisdom contributing religions that are more in antiquity and that aren't really present today in any large numbers. Where was Zoroastrianism? It was mostly found in Persia, which is today like Iran. Is it still practiced? Yes, by people who probably do so at their own peril, because I wouldn't want to actively be participating in that religion the way Iran is today. But there are some, and you should know that, because some people think that this is totally a non-existent religion anymore, but it's not. Now, is it existent to the point that people really understand the subjects, say, that I talk about? Maybe a bit. Not probably a great deal, but some. Okay, so when we talk about preparing for death, for physical death, it doesn't help very much to go to a religious source to help us, we'll say, find answers to the questions of how do you prepare, because those answers are predicated upon myths and religious doctrines that have social and power issues involved in them, created by the predecessors of those religions over time, for various, we'll call it practical, by their standards, manipulative reasons. And that is unfortunate, because that means that the level of truth is relatively low, and the people who think about preparing for death with those ideas may not be doing so with the most, we'll say, accurate understandings. Level of consciousness is reduced because of the misunderstanding or illusion that has been taught and or exercised in methods of the religion. And the motives are unfortunately pretty negative. They're pretty selfish. You know, sometimes it's to give one's resources in a physical sense. Preparing for death is to give one's resources to the religion of choice or control for the person. That's not a good thing. And there are many other factors that come in to play that is contrived and not based upon accuracy of the truth as far as I'm concerned and what you'll hear from me tonight. What are some of the other issues in terms of defining what we're talking about so we best understand what it means to prepare for physical death? Well, there's nothing in tonight's show that is going to explain, we'll say, to anyone specifically why they are going to die at a specific time or place. Let me explain why that's true, and then that will help relieve that issue from most people's minds, because I've been approached countless times with the question of, tell me when I'm going to die. And what can I do about it? Can I blow it up? I want to live longer. And the very nature of that question is riddled with illusion. And so let me put it like this. Each of us will live as long as it is helpful to others in their spiritual service to do so. Okay, did you get that? I'll say it over again, sure. Each of us will live as long as it is helpful to others in their spiritual service, their ability to serve in some spiritual way, as long as it's helpful to them rather than non-helpful to do so. Now, a lot of people look at me with bewilderment, because they'll say, well, what about Hitler? Or what about this dude or that bad crazy person or whatever? How come they were living when it was so terrible for 6 million Jews and another million gypsies and all this other, and all the other people? Well, you see, we're looking at this issue from a relatively narrow viewpoint. The way it would be helpful for, we'll say, as someone as terrible as Hitler, or a whole bunch of people that worked with him and others, and many as bad people today, by the way, is that it acts as a mechanism for people to face their fears of evil and their fears of death, their fears of struggle, their fears of all kinds of things that are evil or dark, and mostly their illusions about life in general, and gets them to make choices that they normally could ignore, that helps build character and builds their ability to grow in consciousness and to become more connected with and a part of, in a creative way, God. Now, does that mean that there has to be evil in order for there to be good? No. It just accelerates the process. Let me give you an example here on Earth so that we can... Earth is an extremely dark planet. Don't believe it? Look at our history. It's one atrocity and war and destruction after another. It's scary. Most worlds are not like Earth. Why is Earth so extreme? It's a laboratory. We are participating in a grand experiment by voluntary means, nonetheless. But unfortunately, the volunteering on a conscious level was done by us while we were part of our soul. In that capacity of consciousness, we chose to be on Earth because we are seeking rapid development of our consciousness from a limited, we'll call it, almost very narrow and confined position of a unfree soul in the mental world, the higher mental world, to liberate ourselves from that position to a freed soul, a liberated soul, in the Buddhic or intuitional world. So that's what we come here for. But we don't come here because we want to gain something for ourselves. We want to do it for all of life. We seek to grow more life that is like God. And that means to sometimes have to fight evil or deal with evil and that sort of stuff. So from that perspective, we have to have some bad dudes and characters running around so that we can do something about them. And so we come here by choice. We don't make people bad. We deal with those that are already in that perspective, the ones that are really atrociously evil. And so we then do what we can to change them. In the physical world, we deal with a lot of things called force-related. But in the astral world, and after that, force becomes unnecessary and even wrong. So it's a whole other kind of way of looking at things. And all of us that are here that aren't evil and that are co-creating with God and being as virtuous as we can be within our illusions and fears, are doing this with a good intention, but we chose to come to this awful place because this is the place where it happens fastest. Remember I said it's a speed thing. Fastest. And so we came with grand intentions. Some of us get lost in the illusion because of the speed issue of wanting to become ambitious, spiritually ambitious. That's an illusion. More so on Earth than almost any place else, people can fall into that trap, particularly during a period of time called the second level of initiation. It's a whole thing. But the point is that it can happen any time, although it's rare to happen beyond this second level of initiation, or particularly past what are called the renunciations and the third initiation. So here we have a remarkable place designed for the folks who want to overcome any spiritual ambition while they grow as much as possible for the sake of growing more of God. And therefore, God's growth is life itself. He created, or it created life, so that we could all grow with it. It's a great thing. So that's what we're doing here. Now, in preparing for physical death, if we can recognize that tenet that I just explained to you, which really has a lot more to do with consciousness than just about anything else that we could probably do to explain it, is a clarifier of preparing for physical death. It starts to change our perspective and to recognize the opportunity that we have while we're physically alive, albeit tremendously difficult by any stretch of the imagination opportunity, that we chose to be in. And that is on the hardest, or one of the hardest of all planets, attempt to reverse the direction of a considerable level of darkness and evil, and bring about, in the most difficult of all dimensions to do this in, which is the physical, a creative change towards God, more enlightenment. And each lifetime, which could be many hundreds, is spent in this amazingly difficult contest, we'll say, with ourselves. It's not about other folks. I know that a lot of people say, oh, well, it's always everybody else who causes it. No, it really isn't. It's about us. I mean, the test is truly an individual test. I know a lot of people are into this group kind of, well, we're really here as a collective kind of thing. And hey, I agree with some elements of that, for sure. There's such a thing as group karma and national karma, which is a part of a world karma. It's all the thing. Yeah, it's great. But individual karma and individual development is how the whole thing is run. You can't substitute somebody else's responsibility and somebody else's consciousness for your own to achieve some kind of spiritual improvement in yourself. It's true that we need the help of others in today's modern and very difficult world. But that is just an added issue. It doesn't subtract the individual necessity for responsibility and for consciousness. Consciousness is individual, as you can see by my definition of death. If it wasn't, you wouldn't die when you lose enough information from your senses to support your individual consciousness. You wouldn't die, right? Well, guess what? You do. So if you're big into the the Obama plan, that we are really all here, we're really all here, because we've got to be here for the common good and the common levels of, we'll call it consciousness and redistribution, communism, if you want to call it. That's all interesting, but it's also wrong. Matter of fact, it's not only wrong, it leads to darkness and evil. So the interesting part about this is, by its very nature, death teaches us something very important. Now, I know you don't like this, because nobody wants to hear that death is good, but it is. It teaches us that on an individual level, we exist, and we are responsible for not only ourselves, but for others in their service, but in our consciousness, we are individuals. The proof is that we die. And we die differently and at different times in different places from the rest of the folks. Right? Okay, so now it starts making some sense. Also, on the other side of the fence, we're born individually. Oh, I know, there's some people that are born as identical twins, but they aren't born exactly at the same time. And the other thing to remember here is that their consciousness instantly from birth is individual. They may share certain elements because they're sharing an awful lot in their spiritual and physical genes. But despite all that, their consciousness is individual. Even if they aren't physically connected, their consciousness remains individual and separate. Wow, that's a kind of strange thing. And if you take, you know, conjoined twins who are sharing 50-70% of their bodies, and one dies and the other one doesn't, what does that tell you? Consciousness is individual. That's what it tells us. There's a lot to learn from death, from physical death. And what else? What else in our defining of elements of the show that we want to understand about physical death? Well, it is, to say the least, disquieting and uncomfortable. Why is that? Why can't we just have a nice, easy physical death? Some religions teach us that that's possible. Is it not true? And besides which, with all the modern things we do these days, why can't we make it so? Well, there's some elements that you can. I mean, if you're, you know, if you're into the Dr. Kevorkian ideas, then possibly you can relieve some of the more, we'll say, nasty parts of physical death for some types of illnesses and diseases, and et cetera, for some people. And is that okay? Well, here's the best way to look at this. Most of the pain and suffering is the result of loss of sense, by the way, actually it's the result of loss of consciousness, which comes from a loss of sense. But suffering is only really true or realized by the person who is suffering as they recognize that they have lost parts of themselves, parts of consciousness. So I'm not talking about pain now. Pain and suffering. Pain is something different than suffering. Pain is the loss of the sense and loss of the ability to gain information and to manipulate or change information in our world. That's a painful thing. Suffering's a bit different. All right, so anyway, pain and suffering do not have to be only alleviated by physical death. Of course, that seems reasonable by most people's standards. But in order to prevent there being pain and suffering during the death or dying or death process, which a lot of people have asked me also, how do I deal with that? I don't want that. It becomes, there's two general ways. The first is to eliminate consciousness, at least from the area where the pain is sustaining from. As you eliminate consciousness, so you put yourself closer and closer to physical death. So there's a negative to that. So as you get injections of morphine or whatever else you're being given, it puts you closer to death. It doesn't reduce death. And if anybody knows what happens in some types of places, hospitals and, you know, other places that you may go to, when they do this, people sometimes end up dying as a result of that process, either deliberately or quite frankly in a non-deliberate way. But the loss of consciousness leads eventually to death. But that's only one of the possible ways. I mean, you could that's to block off the pain, you reduce this system that is so critical. The other way is to enhance the level of information coming from the other centers and as much as possible to balance. This is a little hard to understand. The difference in the center or centers that you're dying from with the other centers. This balance of energies, mostly an energy called chi, allows, for those of you familiar with the other types of languages, called Pingala. But regardless, as we balance these energies, the level of pain is reduced and eventually eliminated. And suffering can be significantly reduced because the person starts gaining another kind of consciousness to replace what is the gradual dying of the physical body. And that is to enhance the person's awareness of their astral and mental centers, particularly their astral, and the person becomes more and more aware of the astral sense and therefore astral consciousness and turns off or no longer functions in as total a way as that person has in the physical world. And some people I've seen do this. I have actually witnessed this happen with people who are dying. They learn how to do this on their own. But could they be taught this? Yes. By someone like me, maybe, or someone who has that kind of understanding, yes. Can be. And so it is possible to achieve this more difficult result. And if you want to complete the process, you don't have to stay in the physical body. For those of you who have been following some of the things I've taught about, you can reach a point where you can say, well, it's about time. I think I'll just leave the physical body. And when you have arranged it so you believe that the physical senses are going to fail, at a certain point, you don't have to be in the body to experience that. And when you do that, that can be a good thing. It isn't always right to do that. Some very advanced people actually stay in their bodies deliberately, even though they can live, because they need to take care of the people around them who are physically there. So they stay conscious, even though they suffer some from that, in order to serve others. But by in that process, as they're focused out more and more towards the others, they feel less and less pain, and they suffer less. So there's a balance there. I know this sounds so complicated, but it really isn't. I mean, I'm trying to define all these things because there is so much illusion about this that if I don't, when we get to the more practical things, you'll start wondering, well, why is he saying that? And if you refer back to this first part of the show, you'll say, oh, it's because of that and that principle and this and that reason. And you'll start seeing that it all starts to make sense for those of you who need that. And I hope you do, actually, for it to make some sense to you. All right. So the most advanced people sometimes don't leave it's those that sort of are pretty far advanced, but maybe not the most of it, they don't have to leave. And if a person is not a person, but they're a liberated soul, liberated from the mental world, they're a master of the ageless wisdom, they truly aren't humans anymore. And nothing really dies to them. In consciousness, they may occasionally take on or give up a body of light that they use maybe for a limited period of time, and then they let go of it. You could call that body dying, but it really isn't, because that when they let go, instead of this gradual method that we call dying for most people, although it isn't that gradual, if you run into a wall at 120 miles an hour or something, you're probably going to die pretty quick, or an airplane crash into the ground at 400 or 500 miles an hour. But the point is that the issue here is that you don't, that is a completely different idea or principle because of the power and force employed, than giving up the body in a enlightened fashion, in which the elements of the body are handed back to the group souls of we'll call it minerals, and it's done in such a gentle and loving way, there is literally no shock to the consciousness that's doing it, which is the great master, and or to the elements themselves and the group souls that are involved in those things. So it's almost an act of beauty, we could call it, rather than some kind of terrible, this horrible thing called, that most people think of as death. So that's another exclusion and difference. Now, how many human beings are going to get there? I don't think too many. I think virtually none. But the point is that we can look at all spectrums. We can include all the things that seem to be really far out to the fringe, because we are learning or gaining a consciousness of death itself and realizing how different it is from what most people perceive. Now, should we be afraid, therefore, of physical death? Well, the fear of physical death is really an illusion, based upon illusion, of what death means and is. At the time a person actually dies, their consciousness expands, at a minimum, to the level of the etheric part of the physical world, because at a minimum, they're going to be in the etheric world for a short time, for days, maybe hours, minutes, but most likely days and even a few weeks. But while they're in that state, they don't feel any physical pain from the physical body. The only suffering that they experience is the inability to sense physical things for the most part. And what limited sense they have in the physical world, they can't do much to change or interact with it. This provides some suffering for some people because their desire may be to continue having that experience which they can no longer have. Now, this is, so you could say it's a self-created suffering, and that would not be wrong, is that? You don't need to create that level of suffering for yourself, but if that's your desire, it might move in that direction for you. For most people, it's a relief. Like, hey, I'm not dead, but I don't know where I'm at. Yeah, and they pretty quickly realize that they're still alive, but they're someplace dimensionally than where they were, and they can still see and hear some things in the physical world, but it's, they're detached, they're separated from it in such a strong way that they have limited, if any, interaction with people who are physically alive. They do get to observe, and observing sometimes is a catharsis, it's a completion, it's a way to finish the life that they had physically. Is it critical that everybody have it? No. Some people go almost immediately onto the astral world. They don't have anything here that they really want to hang on to. A lot of people don't, though. A lot of people have friends, family, and many issues that they didn't prepare for before the physical death. And that's where it gets sticky. Sudden deaths. Like, roof. Yeah, if you run into the ground at 400 miles an hour in an airplane, or a jet plane, that's a pretty serious thing. Then at that point, the person may be disoriented, may have a lack of awareness of what's going on. It's very different than a lingering death from an illness. And they weren't prepared. They couldn't even fathom that this was going to happen because it may have happened so quickly. And their memory of the event itself may be lost. Generally speaking, a very quick death obliterates the last hour or two of the time before death. So, let's say, an hour before you got in an airplane, okay, a jet plane, and it went down. Well, you wouldn't remember getting on that jet plane, most likely. So you might say, well, I was in my car going to the airport. Maybe I had a crash or something. It's the last thing I remember. Or I just arrived at the airport. Yeah. And so to the person, they may be totally disoriented from what actually took place. And so it's a difficult thing. Many times others around them are there if it was a collective death, you know, 50, 100 people, hundreds of people died all at the same time, and they can sort of draw from the sequences of events that are taking place, oh, must have been a plane crash. All these people are dead, huh? And those people can see and somewhat react to each other, but they are also disoriented because of the time issue. So they still can't put together what happened. They can see the results of it, but they can't quite fathom the whole consequences of it. So again, physics plays a role into this thing. And you can say, why? Well, because there's a time dilation difference between the two brains, the etheric and the mental. The mental brain is slower than the etheric, but at the same time, it's slower at compounding memories. So it has all kinds of strange things that it's supposed to interrelate with the etheric brain, and because of these time issues, anything that's very close to death, the etheric brain doesn't have a good record of that it's confused about. Generally speaking, everything is created from the etheric brain, but it's stored from the physical brain. So when you have information come into the physical brain from the physical world, strangely, it then has to get to the etheric brain. The storage is a slow process, and it's awkward and leads to kind of, we'll say, a short-term amnesia between the two brains. If you're taking information from the brain, it's already been stored there. Your third brain's a lot faster. That information comes through a lot quicker, and it's more effective. But if you're trying to get the information stored, that just takes longer into the third brain. If you understand what I'm saying, hopefully you do. All right. So at this junction, I hope I have given enough basics about preparing for physical death so that we can get into some of the really details and examples and a whole bunch of stuff that is preparing. Because we haven't been talking about preparing right now. What we've been talking about are the concepts and the basis for what we're going to be talking about in the rest of the show. And we're going to do that when we come back, and that'll be in about about 2.5 minutes from right now.
What book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hon, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we're talking about preparing for physical death, and I hope that you got some of the basics, we'll say, in the first 40 minutes or so of tonight's show. And the reason for that is that I don't want to keep referring back to those ideas. I would like to move ahead to how to prepare for physical death, which is a more practical side for this whole thing. And maybe then you'll be able to, with the information I've given you tonight, and also you can still go to Life's Hidden Meaning and look it up, look up some of the ideas that I'm going to get into, especially the business about how to prepare to go to a specific realm of consciousness. That part you're going to need to probably get into Chapter 8 and look up how you get to one or the other of the astral subworlds and what you need to be able to get in terms of accurate information joined together in senses, we'll call it, and then using that joined information, apply consciousness or love to the information in ways that that get you in consciousness to those worlds. Then the other question is, can you maintain that consciousness to stay there? So let's start with that part of the equation. When we die, we are going to move eventually, like I said, within weeks or less, to the astral world. Most of us will. Very few are going to become ghosts or some other abnormality, which we won't really cover tonight. So we're going to end up in the astral realm. Now, I know some religions mishandle this issue, and they talk about people trying to go beyond the astral world or live in the lower mental world and some kind of, yeah. It's not going to happen. That's like for people who are extremely advanced. Most likely, we're really talking about masters. And that's not us. So, you know, if you're a master, you already know what to do, and it's not really going to be about the things I'm going to be discussing. So, all right, preparing for physical death is a process of changing our values, changing our perspective, changing our behaviors and interactions with others, changing our, we'll say, motives. And if we're going to be really prepared for physical death, then the concept of death itself takes on a different meaning. When we decide to die, that's the meaning that comes into play. It becomes a product of our individual consciousness connected with our soul. And then looking at the perspective of what service we can provide maximally while we're physically, the remainder of our physical life in comparison to how much service we then or at that moment, or whenever we choose, to transfer our consciousness into our astral body is the focus of existence or life. And would that be better for all others that we're helping to co-serve with? And that becomes an individual choice if we're fully prepared for physical death. So what does that mean? Well, when we remove the idea that death is something that happens to us, rather than something we co-create with and in, with our soul and with God, we remove fear of death, because we're no longer... Death is our choice, based upon what we have both chosen and have decided to share and give with others. And that choice is a choice that creates more consciousness in others, leading to a state of joy. So preparing for physical death, in a spiritual sense, is preparing ourselves to enter a state of joy, and for some, at a minimum, and for others, a state of continuous joy called bliss. That is the state of physical death in an esoteric or hidden way for people who are highly spiritual and highly conscious as well. That's going to be the emphasis of what I'm going to help all of us in preparing for our physical death. So physical death now takes on a whole different perspective than sitting around and, I wonder how I can avoid it. What can I do if I take this supplement and run around the block 3 times and do this and that? Can I live an extra week? You can see how absurd that is as a construct to someone in the perspective of what I just got through explaining. To that person, that would sound like insane. Because if you have the level of control I'm talking about, and the level of choice and creation, and the level of love, then all that other stuff doesn't mean much, except you can use those things as a totality in keeping the physical body and its etheric counterpart as healthy as possible and alive for the period of time that you're going to choose to do the most in your spiritual service. And you will be able to figure out all of those things without that much trouble if you develop the form of consciousness and levels necessary to do what you're here for, your spiritual service. So, amazingly, these things that people are running around and looking for as the fountain of youth and live the forever kind of stuff, and all you need is $19.95 and, you know, plus shipping, those things, while they may have some small issue to the whole creation a person may be making, because there's reality to all parts of existence, including supplements and everything else. There's reality to those things. But those things are of minimal issues in comparison to the person's decision to live a certain period of time and to be of service for a certain period of time. That is the controlling element that leads to the consciousness to be able to live as long as you need to live to perform what you want to do in spiritual service. Most people have it backwards. They're running around looking for the material answer to a spiritual question. So they say, well, if I take all these things, I'll just live longer, and then I'll figure out how I might be of service to others. I know, it sounds crazy, but that's what almost everybody that even has the slightest amount of concern about what I'm talking about actually does. And yet, it's the most backwards way of going about it, and almost always is doomed to fail. Now, I'm not saying that as some kind of mean statement. I'm just saying it as an issue of truth. Now, does it have to be that way? No. That's why I'm doing this show. I'm hoping that I can say, hey, hello out there. you're thinking backwards. You got it wrong. And when people come to me and they say, help me to live longer and not suffer or be in pain, I say, well, my first question is, how long do you want to live so that you can be of service to others? Huh? I swear, that is always my answer. You can talk to people who have talked to me, and they'll tell you, hey, he's telling you the truth. It's what he says. But they don't get it. Yeah, I mean, they look at me and go, huh? Hey, well, what does that got to do with anything? That's to do with everything. That's the problem. That's the crux of the problem. It's your individual choices and consciousness that is really making the decision to die or not, and you don't realize. All right. Wow. I guess I got off on a little thing there. But it is remarkable to me that this area is so much an illusion in our world. Because we're all going to die. Everybody's going to die from the physical body, right? We're all going to do it. And yet, amazingly, with that knowledge, most people are the most befuddled about that issue and the most in illusion and suffer greatly from it and are running around looking at crazy answers that make no sense. But they'll follow this or that because they're desperate from their fear. Now, it's a fascinating element here that if you're afraid of physical death, you're in illusion. That's number one. Almost everybody I meet is afraid of physical death, so they're in illusion. I'll tell you another little secret, if it's a secret. If you're afraid of physical death, you're easily gullible and you're manipulable by evil. And your ability to see and understand evil is almost zero. Whoa. And since most people are afraid of death, there you go. That's the world we're living in. Yep. So guess who uses physical death as its ally? Evil. And that's a big concern because this particular planet is so run by evil, so inundated by it, that this is a leg up. So it's a good thing for us to be preparing for physical death because it prepares us to overcome and deal while we're physically alive with evil and to lose most of our fear. Almost all fear is the fear of physical death. Isn't that amazing? It could be, I mean, literally, it's the way it all boils down to that in eventually. And so here is a subject that is pervasive beyond imagination and ignored almost at the same level that it is pervasive. Boy, are we in trouble, huh? And so for that reason, tonight's show, I don't expect to have as many people listening tonight. Maybe there will be, but I think people, if they look at the show title before they get on the air, I always wait till the very last minute for this reason. They won't listen. They'll say, "Oh, I don't want to listen to that show." Preparing for physical death? No way! I don't want to think about it. And I know that guy will get me to think about it. I don't want to think about it. So you see my little message to my madness, if you want to call it that. That's one of the reasons. Barely ever see a show topic more than a few minutes before I get on the air. If I can help it, it'll be seconds. And so the thing is that way people are more likely to tune in if they're used to listening to me, regardless of the subject. Because after all, you know, whatever the subject is, it's really about God and us in terms of creating more and virtue and light. You know, it's really what it's about, right? Okay. So, let's talk about some of the more pragmatic elements of some of these things. Okay. Well, let's say we can actually get ourselves to face the fear that we're going to die. My suggestion is that it takes about a week or two for most people to functionally meditate about the fact that they are absolutely, positively, without exception, going to physically die. then the next thing you want to get to is that the death of consciousness never occurs. Never. So only physical, astral, mental bodies die. That's it. The body. Consciousness does not die. It grows. So if, as soon as you die, you know, your consciousness goes to another dimension, and it's easier to use that body in that dimension, and the results are a improvement in consciousness. That doesn't make you a super conscious being just because you died from the physical world and you went on to the astral. We know that's not true. But some level of improvement is given instantly. And how we choose to use it, of course, is the bottom line, but still, nonetheless, that's what's going to happen. That starts the process of recovering from the complete and absolute acceptance that we're going to die from the physical body, and eventually everybody. But the point is that that is not what it is made out to be. In reality, people are afraid of death of consciousness, not death of body. They just don't recognize the difference unless they're doing what I call a functional meditation. Functional meditation is something that actually alters our perception in real time while we're dealing with various matters. So I want people to do these kinds of meditations. So I'm going to suggest that for a week or two that we spend time thinking about and trying to recognize our fears and feelings, which may not be just fears, about physical death. And during that particular meditation, we observe to ourselves the various ways that we might anticipate our death. Depends how close you are to that point, but you don't know for sure. And so, and give up with some various issues and options. And the most critical element is to recognize that at the end of this, the end of each meditation, my consciousness is going to go on. It's going to go to a level of the astral world, and we're going to get into this in a few minutes, that I'm going to prepare myself to get to at this time. I'm going to change that perspective if I continue to live long enough in the physical world, and I improve my consciousness overall, especially astral consciousness. Then I will live in a different part of the astral world, so I'll start preparing for that. But this is a preparation now for life, not for death. We're only preparing for the physical death in a relatively meager part of who we are, and then we're preparing for a major transference of consciousness to our astral body. There are a number of things that you want to be prepared for as you leave the physical world, though, in terms of how other people feel, what's going to be done with the assets of physical nature you have, what's going to be done in terms of the, we'll call it astral assets or astral issues, and mental ones. How are you going to allocate those things so that others can benefit the most from them? These are all considerations that should be part of your preparing for physical death. But the other side of the coin is that you also are preparing for astral life. And as long as that is happening in each one of these meditation periods, within 1 to 2 weeks, you will change who you are. Why? Well, let's say that we have some limited level of success. I don't think you're going to all change instantly, and even in a couple of weeks, you're not going to be suddenly different people, but you will become far more conscious about the whole death process. And by keeping it in your conscious state instead of repressing it, you will come up with many creative ways of improving your preparations, including your preparation for astral life. This makes you a true co-creator with God. It brings some joy into your life to see the benefits that other people will derive from this, including in the astral world, and you will be a different person from those perspectives. I know a lot of people say, well, you keep telling us that the meditation isn't the holy thing. Well, yeah, it's not. I've got the rest of the show. I got another hour to go. Give me a chance. Yeah? I'm just starting with some basics here. And these basics, I think, are relevant to almost everybody. Unless you have reached literally like the fourth level of initiation, this stuff is important for you. And until you reach that level, your fear of death is too great, and your responsibility, individual consciousness in dealing with it are not great enough. So these things are relevant to you. Trust me, that's the case. All right. We'll take a little bit of a break right now, and then we'll come back and deal with more of these practical, I hope they're practical ways of dealing with physical death. And hopefully that will happen. If you are unaware of this, every month now we're going to have a discussion group over at the Pyle Adult Recreation Center, 655 East Southern Avenue. I'm just telling you about it so you can prepare to be there. You have choices. Last time we had four people, theoretically, there over the conference phone, which is fine. I don't care if there's 100 people on that. As many as you want to attend, if you want to attend to that, just make sure you contact us, like at least that day, if not the day before, so we can arrange it. It's a little bit complicated doing the whole thing. And this is kind of new, so we're trying something out. Eventually, we had about 20 people physically there, but eventually I would like to have more people, etherically, or on the conference phone, than are physically able to attend, because after all, you have to be living in the neighborhood, as they say, to get there. So that's the first thing to be concerned about, is whether you want to be there. And if you do, it's the second Monday of each month. That's when you can attend, and it's from 7 to 8:30 p.m., and that is Pacific time. I know we're in Arizona, but you got to figure Pacific time, because that's what we're on right now until we switch over, and then we'll be on what other people call the mountain time. But we don't change to mountain daylight savings time. We just stay on mountain time, which is the same as Pacific daylight savings time. We're in Phoenix, and we don't need more sun. We got enough. Let's put that early in the morning, and we'll worry about it then. So that's how we change our day, 7 to 8 p.m., so we're to 8:30 p.m., and that's the same time that like places like L.A., San Francisco, the whole West Coast of the United States is on during like 8 or 9 months of the year. They're actually on that time. All right, so please, if you want to attend that, put it on your schedule, and we'd love to have you attend. And again, you don't have to live out of the area. If you just want to be there and you say you live across town, you don't feel like driving, that's okay. You could be on the phone. If you haven't tried it out, you should try the ICE Center. A friend of mine, David Stacy, he's an OD. He runs the center along with another doctor. And Lorraine and Christy are the assistants. You can phone them at 480-899-0188. They'll help you to see better. And I like the guy. He's a really good guy. He spends a lot of time actually in service to others and doing many great things besides his paid practice. TheEyeCenter.org. You can go online and look at it. It's called the Eye Center, of course. Southwest corner of Alma School and Elliott in Chandler. One more time, 480-899-0188. Give him a call. And if you haven't tried 5G GZIC or any of the 5G products or anything like that, check it out at buygzik.com. Buygzik, all one word, .com. 602-431-5162. And you can get some. It's on sale. $30 a big bottle. I think it's 13, something like that. 12 or 13. $1 for the smaller travel size kind of bottle. So you could check that out as well, and it may be something that you find is very important. Also check out Ideal Sorption Resveratrol. I use it every day. I must say, I think it's helping. If it helps keep your body younger, your physical body younger, that's its best use. You also check out Soul Balance, which is another great product, expensive, but it really works and has many benefits. Okay, so I'm coming back now to our subject tonight, and that is preparing for physical death. So what else now do we want to look at in terms of being prepared? You know, one of the things that is, at least in my life, in looking at preparation, is I prioritize the things that I would like to do in a spiritual sense. What, in other words, what is it that I'm here for, and how do I accomplish those things? How long do I need to do or to live to be able to do those things? And here's an odd question I ask myself. How long do I really want to live in order to accomplish that in a physical sense? And this is all just put together a good, if not excellent, way of being a co-creator in your life. The more you're a co-creator, the more physical death is a choice rather than an accident or a result that you're out of control with. If you decide that you're capable of and you want to live longer because of certain spiritual reasons, I can virtually guarantee you that if your actions and motives are put together coincidingly, that's your motive, but if you actually put it into action, you will live as long as needed to do exactly what that co-creation is. Now, you have to be doing it, though. You can't say, well, I'm going to do it, so I'll live 20 years and then I'll start. Well, you'll probably live 2 years and be dead, because you can't cheat. When you cheat, in other words, your motives are not running the same as your actions. When you have that take place, you get negative results. You build up a thing called negative karma. And negative karma is there to both counter our bad motives and to help us to straighten out, maybe before we do physically die, but in either case, it certainly adds to physical death. It creates forces in our life. Karma is energy going against energy in our bodies. It creates forces in our life that are death-inducing over time, because it stops the chi from doing what it's supposed to do, from flowing freely and keeping all the systems alive. And once you start doing that, you got bad news. One of the worst ways of inducing bad karma is to say, I'll pretend like I'm going to do something, or I'll say I'm going to do something, and I know I got the right motive because I really would like to do it. In other words, you have desire, which is a feeling. But you know what? I'll get to that next week, next month, next year, next decade. Well, you'll probably be dead before you get to the decade period. But regardless, I mean, if you truly start going this down that road, that's a real bad road, because you're creating a lot of forces that will probably curtail your existence. So you need to be truly, truly honest and truly willing to do and doing the things that you see as being virtuous, and they have to be, in your feedback from others, resulting in virtuous issues. You can't just say, well, I think it's virtuous to go kill a bunch of people. Well, if the whole society around you say, oh, that's not really bad, it's a very bad thing, we're going to do terrible things for you for doing it, you're going to have terrible things done to you for doing it. So it has to be in feedback from all those that you are supposedly co-serving and helping to serve with helping. You can't, in your own little bubble, say, well, I think it's right. I don't know. Everybody else knows it's terrible, and it's hurting them. But I'll just keep doing it anyway, because I know it's all right. No. That's a lack of humility, to say the least, if not arrogance. And it shows a person in great illusion. So it's the illusions we have that bring on the experience of death that we're not in control of. Controlled death shows that we are out of illusion out of fear, and we're living our life in a co-creative way, which brings about at a minimum joy and possibly bliss, depending upon how long and how consistent we do it. Wow. So we have formulas here. I'm trying to give you some of them that need to be put into place if we're going to prepare for physical death. All right. What else, then, do we need? Well, if you have commitments with other people, we'll call them your spiritual group, if that would be permissible here. Most people that are in a spiritual group do not recognize it as such. But regardless, it doesn't matter. If you do or don't, if others are co-creating in goodness with you, I'll call that a spiritual group, because by my definition, that's it. And that is where your commitments need to be consistent and helpful the most. If you aren't doing that, then, again, lots of negative karma, lots of forces moving way closer and faster to physical death. The more you show a lack of love in the universal sense and wise love in the metaphysical sense, the faster you're going to move towards physical death. What is wise love? Wise love means you're giving to others so that they can wisely give to others themselves. And that is the rub. If most people give to others in a personal way, which makes them or the others feel good. But that's not what I'm talking about. And if you do that, you're going to move closer to physical death. So you could say, well, I love everybody. I'm so loving. How come I'm so sick and I'm dying? Well, what are you giving to other people? Well, everything they want and desire and everything that makes me look like a good guy, a good person. Well, that's not wise giving, is it? Well, it may not be wise, but it sure makes me very popular. Oh, I'm giving to my children. They're getting all the benefits of my wealth and everything. Yeah, well, are they wisely giving, become wiser givers? Oh, no, they're selfish. They want more. Oh, okay. That's a really good system you're working on. I wonder how that's going to work out for you. You think your children and you are going to move faster towards physical death through that process? Ooh. That's right. Not only do we hasten our own physical death and make it miserable, besides, because we lose, by our own fears and illusions, any control over it, but we do so for those that we supposedly love when we unwisely give to them. Unwise giving. Ooh. It's a tough one, I know, because so many people have such unconditional love for family and friends that they overlook their responsibility on a soul level to be wise and to help those others in a more tough love, maybe in some way, at times, to only receive or get something from us when they are using it to serve others. In a way that is truly soul-serving. It's a big problem. I would say that 98% of the wealth transfer from one generation to the next is done unwisely. Part of the reason is that we're dying so early, we're unwise when we die. And so our wealth transfer to, in a material wealth sense, but also in other ways, to family, children, friends, whatever, is done with the worst results, unwisely. Would it help for us to live longer, but more importantly, to live more consciously? Yes, because then we wouldn't do such crazy stuff. We wouldn't give maybe anything to some of those people we give to, because we only hasten their death and their suffering. Wow, we deny the rest of the world the benefits of what we have. Instead, these other folks, their children, friends, whatever, are going to misuse, abuse, and destroy themselves and everything else around them from what we give them. Talk about a unwise use of wealth. How often is this done? I said 98% of the time. I mean, I think it's more than that, but I don't want to get too extreme. It's almost all the time. It really is. Well, I do it because they're my children. Oh, they're rotten son of a bitches. Oh, they don't really care about much of anything. I hope they use it well. Hope. Okay. How do we deal with people that are close to us through family associations or friendships that are selfish? How should we deal with the selfish in our life? Well, first of all, it is our responsibility, if we have a close enough relationship with anyone, to help them to become virtuous, unselfish. It is our responsibility, up to the point where they accept whatever that we can do with and for them. And we should never be giving to them things that they are selfishly using, because there are so many compounded errors in doing that, that it creates terrible karma for ourselves and for them and for who knows how many. We're adding darkness into the world that's unnecessary, if not stupid. We better take your wealth and burn it. I'm serious. Burn it. If it doesn't burn, destroy it in some other fashion. I mean it. Well, why not give it to the Red Cross? How about Habitat for Humanity? How about the Humane Society? How about this or that? Indiscriminate giving to what people consider to be charities is equally destructive. Why? Because unless you've been directly involved in a co-creative way with those folks, what you're doing basically is denying your individual responsibility to be creative. It's like saying, well, I can't give it to my kids because they're really, really way too selfish. So I'll give it to PBS. The problem with that is you're being selfish when you do that, see? Because you think that giving will get you off the hook. I'll give it to somebody, that way I get some kind of brownie points, don't I? No, you get bad karma. I know, but what about all those people who are going to hear someone talk on the radio or TV and... Or what about the animals that get sheltered, et cetera? Well, if those societies really deserve what you were giving them, you would be working with them. You should, in some way. And they wouldn't be doing atrocious things. And most of them are doing some bad things. PBS takes a political position that's against God in many ways. Now, I'm not going to get into why. You'll have to figure that one out. Read Ayn Rand. Okay. And then the Humane Society kills more animals than any other group, including county agencies. Did you know that? Probably not. Oh, they say they really can't do anything else because they have too many animals and not enough resources. They can only keep them 3 to 5 days, whatever. That's not good enough. How would you feel if someone knocks on your door and you say, well, we ran out of resources, so sorry, it's been 5 days, we're going to have to shoot you or gas you? Would you consider that a humane society or an inhumane? I know this is tough. Some of you are listening to me and probably going, oh, my. Look it. I'm not trying to lay any trips on people. I'm just trying to get to the truth of the issue. The truth of the issue is that most charity giving is a con game by both the charity and the person giving. They're each trying to get something they can't get the way they're doing it. You have to be responsible individually for what you co-create, for the virtue that you're going to make in the world. If you're not willing to take that kind of responsibility, then burn the money. Destroy the asset. It's better. Better than the approach we're making. Now, that's not a good approach, necessarily. There are better ones. But the general principle about preparing for physical death is to use all wealth in the highest and best way you possibly can perceive it. That you have some level of individuality in the process as well. Not where you just say, I'll write the check, where do I go, where do they do, and that's the end of it. No. You should be involved in some way. More, better. Make it a point that it's something that's so deep in your heart and so incredibly enlightening to your mind and the mind of others that it is the best. Few people, I guess it's less than 2% that die, do that. Just that one act. If you can do that, prepares you greater for almost anything else you can do for going to a higher level in the astral world, for living a more conscious life, for increasing the joy in your existence, for doing all the things we're talking about. And yet, so few people do the right thing. I don't get it, but I guess I do. I mean, on one side, I can intellectually explain it. On the other side, it just jolts me every time I talk about it. Like, how can they all be so dense, so illusioned to not figure this sort of stuff out? I even wrote it in a chapter in Life's Hidden Meaning, and most people skip over it. So I read that business you talked about, giving to the charities and nonsense. I just thought that was a goofy thing, the way you presented that. What's wrong with charities? They're a good thing. You know? Yeah. All right. So does that mean that all charities, by the way, are bad? No. Charity is a wonderful thing. But it must be individually involved with. And if you're not doing that, you're not part of that group. And then there's something wrong with what you're doing. The process should always be to the highest and best use. Your consciousness dictates where and how is the best way for you to get. The higher your consciousness, the more it must be in a higher way. Otherwise, you're just like it. All right, so what else? What other things can we do to prepare for physical death? Well, as people grow older, they're supposed to get wiser. So one of the admissions we must make is that the physical aging process that we are going through has been brought about by our own illusions. I know that's a tough thing for so many folks because they don't want to believe that. They don't want to believe that all the aches and pains and illnesses that they have as they grow older are their own making. It seems disquieting. And, of course, when you include prior karma, especially for younger people that have illnesses, it's really burdensome. Well, how can I control my prior karma? Well, you can undo it. You can create enough good karma now and do enough good things so any prior karma goes away. It isn't like it's inevitable. But it's tough. It's tough to accept responsibility for things that seem so difficult. Why? Because modern medicine, the allopathic model of Western medicine, Obamacare is the extreme of it, says we're not responsible. It's not us that makes us sick. It's those bad things out there. Or a lack of education. If we just knew what we should eat and how we should rest and how much exercise we should get and everything else, which the government could explain to us and make us do, eventually forcing us, the answer would be so clear to us. Life more abundant, health everywhere, expenses going way down about health care. It's going to be great. Couldn't be more aligned than almost anything you could create is aligned. Our consciousness is individual, so is our health. Our health is based upon how much of an illusion we are. Because our health eventually leads to death, right? The lack of it. And therefore, death comes from illusion. You see how it is so plain and simple. So what should we do about that issue of us growing older and losing sense, which loses capabilities and all these other things, and the body withering, becoming infected, losing its life-giving energies, and it dying in slow or sometimes faster fashion? What can we do? Well, all the things that we talk about of being healthy are part and parcel of service. If we, through our desire to serve, decide to walk, run, exercise, eat right, sleep right, etc., everything works. Those things are helpful. If we do it because we just want to live longer so we can be a couch potato, and because so we can do irresponsible things and selfish living and have a lot of material stuff besides, because we like those things, it doesn't work. Suddenly you wake up one day and there's a very old face, very tired person, very ill person that's looking back. And you say, well, how did I get this way? How about you made yourself that way? It's time for us to take responsibility for health and illness. The taking of that kind of responsibility is extremely difficult in a society that runs on a principle called allopathic medicine that's 100% wrong. 100% wrong. In other words, the model does not explain the reality. The model is based upon the need for certain people to be in a position of power and control, and for others, to, for reasons of fear, to go to them or to be controlled by them, it's the government really, because we can't deal with being responsible ourselves. So take responsibility for your health. Do that in various ways, which include doing things that have been shown to be helpful, but try them for yourself and make sure that they really do work. And at the same time, reject most of the allopathic model. What parts do you not want to reject about the allopathic model? Well, it has to do with structural issues. If, as an example, you break your leg or you have some physical terrible thing happen to you, something falls on your head or whatever, the allopathic model says, well, that's a thing that we can handle. Come on in, and we'll do emergency treatment on you or this or that, and they can help it to heal faster. That model's okay, because you're taking a physical event and changing it around to a physical correction. There's nothing wrong with it. I call it the plumbing model. Plumbing mostly involves emergency treatment and or some alleviations on a constructive or physical side of the body, treatment, chiropractic, some types of surgeries, but most of it is emergency stuff. Now, it's plumbing. I call it plumbing. Why does the rest of the allopathic model, which deals with chronic ailments, which has it's failed, and I mean almost 100% failure there, it causes more injury because the drugs that are used and the treatments that are used actually cause a shortening in longevity. The third most common form of causing death in Western countries that use allopathic models is medicine. I'm talking about all forms of medicine, including drugs, is the third most common way of killing of people dying. And it's usually not included in statistics unless you look carefully, in some places do include it. Third most common form of death. Tell me that isn't pretty serious. So the model that we're using is the third most fatal thing we can do in our life. That doesn't make much sense. Now, if you have some kind of accident, going to a plumber to help fix the body's bones or whatever. Okay. Allopathic models work best on truly physical occurrences, but they work worst on occurrences that are outside of what we call accidents. Remember, accidents are still a loss of sense, so you're still responsible. But the point is that that model, it has some effectiveness. Almost all other areas of health, it is the opposite. It causes death. Third most common form. Whoa. Didn't know that. Okay, well, now you know. So, staying away from the allopathic model for all chronic illnesses and ailments, and for most conditions involved with quote-unquote improving longevity or health in general, ignore, because it's wrong. What models do work? The models that work are somewhat biblical. It's herbs and stuff like that. It's in the Bible, God created herbs in the Western Bibles, in Christian Bibles. I mean, the point is that that works, and because the qi, you want to correct the qi issues, and plants have a lot of different qis, and we can use different herbs to do different things. In addition, what works the most is what we've been talking about in the show. Spiritual service, changing your life to an enlightening position, all things will be improved upon. Do not exceed your physical sense ability to try to serve beyond that, because that would be spiritually ambitious and irresponsible, because then you'll fail. You always match your ability to sense, and therefore your responsibility is up to your ability, so that you serve at the maximum level, then you're doing the best you can. So let's say you've created a heart congestive problem and you can barely walk around, and in order to serve in a certain way, you're going to have to be able to climb a mountain or something. Forget it. Don't try it. Don't do it, because you would be doing it for wrong motive. Instead, find the areas that you can be responsible with. Maybe find all the people who can climb the mountain and help them to get together to do it together. That will work. Maybe spend some time on the phone or emails or computer or whatever and do that. That's okay. Here again, we're matching the service to one's capabilities so they can be responsible. Responsibility means that you have not exceeded your level of capacity wisely to serve, and it means that you're not spiritually ambitious either. So you're doing the right things when you do that. That also causes healing. If you are responsible in your service, your body will naturally heal itself over time. If you are in a very serious condition of dying at the moment, you've gone a long way down this path in the wrong direction, you may need certain allopathic methods for the next month or two or something, just to keep you literally alive. But still, you need to make the changes that I suggest and then switch over to as much naturopathic ways as possible, balancing those with the quickness of the allopathic approach. It's okay, allopathic medicine in an extreme situation when the body is about going or expiring is okay to try, but not on an extreme measure. Do not use all your resources to stay alive an extra week or two. As an example, that would be stupid. You would stay alive a lot longer by using whatever resources you have to help others to serve wisely. That will keep you alive a lot longer. And miraculously, and I say miracle now, miraculously, you will recover as much as possible. It's all based upon karmic issues that if you really have the consciousness, you'll be able to figure it out for yourself. But even if you don't, and you generally apply the principles, it'll work for you. That's the good news about tonight's show. You don't have to completely understand everything to be able to live in ways that are virtuous. And you don't have to be totally wise to be somewhat wise. And that's better than being a total fool and in illusion and ignorance. You see? Hopefully that makes some sense. All right, let's move on. Preparing for physical death. What else do we need to be looking at? Well, our family and friends. We need to prepare all the people around us for the fact that someday we're going to die, they're going to die, everybody's going to die from the physical world. Our job is to prepare everyone for this event so that their reactions are not fearful, but of enlightened, we'll call it, co-service. They want to be involved in our service, and they want us to be involved in theirs, and everybody's working towards that goal. Then nobody's running around with their heads chopped off, their heads are chopped off. Oh, grandpa, grandma, great-grandma, they're all dying. I don't know what to do. I got to go grieve and do this. I'll go get a grieving counselor. No, that's all self-focused, right? Instead, it should be, what can I do? Is there anything I can do for you while you're dying? And can I help co-serve with you so you don't suffer as much and so you don't die as fast? If they can say that to you, then you've succeeded in helping them. You see? So teaching is a sense of this situation. People who are closer to death become better teachers if they can get over their illusion of the death, which death helps us to do because it pushes buttons and we start seeing, yeah, we're going to die. Then we can help others by becoming better teachers at that point. And people accept it more from those who show a lack of fear of death, not because they're suppressing it or repressing it, but because they don't have it. Nothing is more enlightening to those who are caught in the illusions of the physical world than to have someone, those around us who are would normally be frightened are not, who normally are not afraid of evil, who would be afraid of evil are not, who are normally afraid of death, who are not, who are normally self-focused and in illusion about zillions of things, and unwisely giving to many people, who are not. Those people liberate. They liberate by example, and they liberate by they can teach. Become a great teacher. And that's a great way to prepare for physical death. Teach others. I have so many people, older people, tell me, well, I can't get out much. What should I do? And I said, well, what do you understand? Well, I understand all the stuff in your book, and it's the great stuff. Then get on the Internet and start teaching it. Start blogging or start having open discussion groups or whatever. For heaven's sake, there's so few people that can do that. Do it. Yeah. All right. I'm being a little bit too exaggerated about this. Maybe. I have to admit, this is a sore point with me. Because it happens so often. And there's so many people in this illusion. It's scary. It's like I'm living on another planet where everybody on that planet is like not a real person. They're just sort of controlled by fears and illusions and nuttiness and the very things they don't want to happen, they're creating. And you know, I look at this and I say, what is going on here? Well, yeah, I know. It's tough. It's real tough. Helping other people to awaken as a liberating way of living ourselves. So use that as a means. Use that as a means. And it definitely gets you over the fear of death if you do that, by the way. It really works. Okay, what about the people who aren't, quote-unquote, truly afraid of death, but they're afraid of life in the astral world? How do those folks deal with the situation? Because they are aware enough, we'll say, to realize they haven't lived the best life, isn't the worst life, isn't lived the best. And they really want to live a more meaningful life in the astral world. They've read stuff that I've written and some other folks. And they say, you know, probably going to be on the fifth or the fourth, the astral subworld. It's not the worst place to live, but I know I could do better. And if I keep worrying about it, I'll probably even do worse. It's self-focused and it's contradictory. And I want to go to a better world, but I don't know. I don't deserve it. Well, here's the point. First of all, that is somewhat spiritually ambitious. It's also self-recriminating. And it fails to recognize this truth. We are as spiritual as we are right now as far as spirituality is concerned. So no matter what you did yesterday or a week ago or a year ago or a lifetime ago, that isn't you. It's who you are right now and every now from now on. That is the thing that matters. Oh, I know if you're Catholic or this or that, they tell you that all those things you did are really bad and there's purgatory and there's this and that. Okay. You can choose that religious viewpoint, or you can take on the one that is probably the one that's correct, which is that you are as spiritual as you function now and in the future. Your past is the past. If there's something you've done that can be changed now, then that's the now. Then change it. But the most of your past you can't change. It's done. And the more you sit around and pontificate about that and worry about that and go to somebody and confess it and whatever else is going to happen, the less you're going to be spiritual now and in the future. So it's a backwards movement. It doesn't really serve. It's okay to recognize you've done those things. It's okay to say, this is how I want to live now, and I choose to do it. That's the correction. I am living in light now. We've all done every imaginable bad thing sometime in some lifetime. Just accept it. There's enough bad things out there and enough lifetimes, enough time, to have done them. And so almost all of them have at one time or another been part of us. Are we going to sit around, pontificate, and confess, and worry, and who knows what else? That's going to block us from getting to a higher spiritual level when we move on. But most importantly, it's going to prevent us from doing it right here, right now. It's okay to worry about where you're going to go in the astral. Well, that's not an impossible thing to be concerned about. You can be concerned about that. But you can't interfere with or prevent you from doing what you need to do now here. And if you're that close to dying, let's say you are, then it still doesn't help to worry about where you're going. Instead, to continue to serve at the highest level, because when you die, whatever level you're at, it will control where you end up, at least for minutes, if not days and years. So give yourself that opportunity. And once you get there, your consciousness will expand to some level. God's grace, I call it, and you'll have even more opportunity to serve even more. You may not get to the highest levels of the astral world immediately. It's tough to be in those places because no matter how much we care to deny it, we live so much in illusion here that even if you get rid of half of it, you're probably not going to make it to the spiritual sub-worlds immediately. Maybe within a few years you will in the astral world. Remember, you live a long time, longer than here. And so you've got a good opportunity and it's far. Life is far from over. You've got maybe hundreds, if not a many, many hundreds of years to live in the astral world, and great opportunities to be of service there, but not as much service as you could have been while you're physically alive, because the physical world is where energy is most dense and it's pulling us down. It's also where evil is most likely to be destructive to the planet. So we need to deal with stuff while we're here, of course. Don't throw this life away to go live someplace else in the future. That would be totally nutso. There's some religions that teach you to do that, but that's just craziness. We are here for extreme importance. And we need to be doing what we can while we're physically alive. But if you're close to physical death, you know it. It's okay to be concerned about the afterlife as well. There's no reason not to be. And be reasonable with yourself. Be close to your soul. How do you get closer to your soul? You get closer to your soul by being of service to others and not being selfish or self-focused. Soul is not a self-focused being. Humans are. We are condemned with a consciousness that is overridden by individuality. The soul is able to balance its individuality with the individuality of all others that it interacts with. We can't do that because we use our senses in selfish ways because of the dense energies that we use to sense with. The soul doesn't have those dense energies to sense with. So it would be just like us if it did, because it is us. So it says a part of me's got to go into these denser realms to get illusion because the rest of me can't go, or I'll lose it just the way that's going to lose it. The human that's part of me is going to lose it when it goes. And remember, there's only one human being connected to one individual human soul. Only animals and less have group souls. We do not. That individuality gives us great, great creativity, which allows us to get close to our Creator and to even recognize our Creator and understand our Creator, and then to co-create with it. Animals can't do that. Plants for sure can't do that. Minerals can't do it. We can do it. That makes us so incredibly special, but also weak, because we come to these realms where the dense energies make our senses go crazy. We can't keep our senses and consciousness in alignment. So the sense gives us information that reduces our consciousness when we use it in wrong ways, because the information itself is incomplete, it's an illusion. And so we just come up with terrible answers to very important questions. We call it mistakes, but what it really is a lack of consciousness. We can choose to grow that consciousness while we're here and also when we go to the astral world. And then, of course, eventually the mineral world. But that's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years into the future. All right, those are astral risks. So when we look at the preparing for physical death subject, I guess the bottom line comes out to something like this. Each person comes here with incredible resources. We have spent many, many hundreds of lifetimes learning something about how to deal with physical energy. It is so dense, it is so overwhelming, and it has a mind of its own, at least we call it gravity, but it has a mind of its own that is so strong that we cannot easily control it. We find ourselves in a contest with our own bodies. The body is physical, it's energy, it's a form of density of energy that itself is less dense when it's flowing. So we have this combination that we as spirit are supposed to join with and co-create more of God. But the spirit part is almost always at the disadvantage to this energy in the physical world. Yet the spirit part has to get the physical part to respond in unison, or there won't be any virtue or light created in the form around it and in it. as the spiritual part enlightens the form itself, it gains control over what we call death. It chooses how and what and when the physical body is no longer going to be controlled by the consciousness within it, which includes the spirit. Spirit is a consciousness as it should be represented or could be represented by God. And that is us. We are dominated in our thoughts by consciousness, but in our physical bodies, it doesn't dominate the form or energies. All we can do is to gain greater and greater understanding or consciousness about the physical body by inhabiting it. You can't be a Gnostic. You can't throw away the physical body because that would just alleviate all the illusion and you would become naturally a great spiritual being. Not true. That's not God's plan. The Gnostics are wrong about that. Instead, God's plan is that spirit must go into the physical body. It needs to become part and join, but in a way that develops wisdom and universal kinds, unconditional kinds of love that have great wisdom, and also that eventually becomes a soul here in this world. Now, can it do it? Yes, it has all kinds of methods of doing it, which connects itself to the soul through the helping solar angel, and it allows the spirit to be able to eventually accomplish this. It is not impossible, it's just very difficult. If lifetime can be a move forward, the more we consciously choose to do this, and the faster we do it, the more we are preparing for physical death, and the more we're not going to die in any bad or negative way, and the more we will enjoy life in every completed sense, and the more we'll be prepared for the life in the next dimension and in the next body that our consciousness will be fully conscious in. We do have some small amount of consciousness in our astral body, but it mostly leads to a sense of desire for things rather than true love. We can build on that while we're physically alive, but the most important thing is for spirit to reach a balance in the physical body with the form. That balance is achieved when we are in a state of selflessness and service with, for, and about others. Let that be the guide for preparing for physical death. And some of the illusions I've talked about, and there are many other ones, I just had to kind of let go of the rest of what I was going to talk about, we're just out of time, but those illusions will not be illusions anymore. Whole vistas will open, and the spirit will become freed from the illusion of the energy that is incorporated in it, within it, and about it. And it will realize that it is the being. It is the being that is truly immortal. And it is taking this less than immortal body and using it to its maximum purpose, allowing these very basic things we call minerals and cells and other things to explore their own level of consciousness at what minimal level they exist, so they grow as well. It's an amazing process. Once you get into it, you begin to understand that you are God, especially within your own body. And this becomes an empowerment that nothing can stop once it becomes growth enough for you to say, I got it. I got it. Re-listen to tonight's show. Maybe you'll get it. And I hope that I have made this somewhat simpler than it can be. And if you still are missing it, re-listen to the show and also get Life's Hidden Meaning. Read Chapter 7. There's a whole bunch in there about some of this. Read Chapter 6 about souls. That'll help. Chapter 5 about consciousness. And then Chapter 8 about other dimensions of time and space, which includes how these bodies interact with each other. Do all of that, and you will prepare for not only physical death, but for life after death indefinitely. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.